This is VOCM News Talk. Call 709-273-5211 or 1-888-590-8626. The views and opinions of this program are not necessarily those of this station. Here's VOCM News Talk host Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone, and what a difference a day makes. Hey, Claudette, yesterday, my goodness gracious, you couldn't find a better winter day, could you?
I know, and then you look out today and it was RDF.
RDF, just like the spring of the year, sure.
Sprinter.
I'm not going to complain.
No, not at all, especially now that when you look at the Environment Canada winter storm warning, Linda.
I haven't. I have to be honest with you. I've been facing eyes and other things today.
I know, you're so busy. And I just noticed that they are saying now 40 to 70 for the Northern Avalon, including St. John's and Vicinity. I know that
they
were. Yeah, up to 70. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're saying a lot, actually. It's going to be heavy on Thursday evening, as you know, because you've been reporting on this, that it's early, right up until early Saturday morning. And then they're talking about how along the southern shore, it's likely to see that the snow will transition to the ice pellets. And the ice pellets are expected to change back to snow on Friday. And you got all these gusty winds, too. And they're saying considering to postpone non-essential travel until conditions improve. So they're putting it out there now with the winter storm warning.
Excellent.
For sure. Because before it was a lot of, like, you know, uncertainty. But now it seems to be more certain.
Great. That's what I always like, a bit of certainty around my uncertainty. Yeah, up to 70, is that right? Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, so don't put your shovels away yet,
nope,
folks.
Have it near your door.
We'll be keeping you up to date on all of that, as you can appreciate. But lots of different kind of news today. And one of them is an update on the situation involving the death of a woman, a suspicious death of a woman, found in Outer Cove yesterday morning. Well, investigators are now treating the death of a woman whose body was found in Outer Cove as a homicide. RNC Constable James Cadigan provided this update to reporters at RNC headquarters today.
We're here to bring an update to an ongoing investigation into a suspicious death, which is being treated as homicide by the RNC. So I'll start off by bringing us up to speed. You know, around 10 a.m. yesterday morning, March 5th, yes, patrol services and the Criminal Investigation Division, along with Forensic Identification Services, responded to the area of Liam Drive in the town of Logie Bay, middle of Outer Cove. Shortly after arrival at scene there, a woman was found deceased inside of a property. The RNC is sending its sincere condolences to the family and friends of the deceased. So we will and are currently referring to the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner to determine the cause of death. So as this investigation is progressing, we want to bring up some points that can help us in our process here in gathering information. So the victim was last seen in the area of Middleton Street in St. John's, and investigators are looking to speak with anyone, any witnesses from this area who may have seen anything suspicious between 8 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. yesterday, March 5th. Police are also seeking any video footage, whether it be CCTV, dash camera, cell phone, doorbell cameras, during that same time period, involving a blue four-door Hyundai Elantra that traveled from the east end of St. John's in the area of Middleton Street to the area of Liam Drive in Outer Cove, where that woman was found deceased. One other point that we would like to make clear is that this was a targeted attack, and there is no threat to public safety in connection with this event. I can go ahead and take some questions at this point.
Have you made any arrests?
So right now, what I can tell you is that we do have a suspect identified, and as we progress this investigation, we will provide updates as to what action is to follow.
So that's an update that RNC Constable James Cadigan provided to reporters, including VOCM's Richard Duggan, earlier today at RNC headquarters concerning the homicide of a woman found in Outer Cove yesterday in a vacant home on Liam Drive. And they have pictures of a vehicle that they are interested in. They have a suspect identified, but they want to know more about the movements of this particular vehicle that they say traveled from Middleton Street to Liam Drive in Outer Cove. And anyone who may have dash cam or doorbell cam or surveillance video showing that vehicle traveling to Outer Cove, they're looking to get your assistance. So there you have it. When we come back, the Bank of Canada's key interest rate remains steady at 5%. We'll hear what Governor Tiff Macklem had to say today. When we come back after this, this is News Talk on VOCM.
Stay informed and have your say on the news of the day with your VOCM. Join Linda Swain weekday afternoons from 4 to 5 p.m. for an hour of talk and discussion with decision makers and listeners like you. News Talk on your VOCM.
Are back. The Bank of Canada's key interest rate remains steady at 5%. Governor Tiff Macklem says they need more time to allow higher interest rates to do their work, indicating it's still too early to lower rates. The rate of inflation dropped to 2.9% in January. That falls within the target range of between 1% and 3%. And while the economy is showing signs of weakening, price pressures remain high. Macklem provided the update in Ottawa today.
But with inflation still close to 3% and underlying inflationary pressures persisting, the assessment of the Governing Council is that we need to give higher interest rates more time to do their work. With that in mind, the Governing Council decided to maintain the policy interest rate at 5%. We're also continuing our policy of quantitative tightening. In January, we indicated that our confidence had increased, that our policy rate was high enough to restore price stability. And while we could not rule out the need to raise rates further if there were new inflation surprises, we indicated that our discussions were shifting from whether our policy rate is restrictive enough to how long it needs to stay at the current level. Today's decision reflects the Governing Council's assessment that a policy rate of 5% remains appropriate. It's still too early to consider lowering the policy interest rate. Recent inflation data suggests monetary policy is working largely as expected, but future progress on inflation is expected to be gradual and uneven, and upside risks to inflation remain. Governing Council needs to see further and sustained easing in core inflation.
Depuis notre décision de janvier, il n'y a pas eu de grande surprise.
Council believes that we need to spend more time to let prices stabilize. That is why the overnight rate will remain at 5%. And the bank will continue its policy of quantitative tightening. In January, we said we were more confident that our policy rate was high enough to restore price stability. While we could not rule out the need to raise rates further if there were new inflation surprises, we indicated that our discussions were shifting from whether our policy rate is restrictive enough to restore price stability to how long it needs to stay at the current level. Today's decision reflects Governing Council's assessment that a policy rate of 5% remains appropriate. It's still too early to consider lowering it. Recent inflation data suggests that monetary policy is working largely as expected, but further progress on inflation is expected to be gradual and uneven, and upside risks to inflation remains. Governing Council needs to see further and sustained easing in core inflation.
U.S. economy also slowed, but has remained surprisingly strong even as inflation has continued to decline. In Canada, economic growth has come in somewhat stronger than projected in the January NPR, but the pace remains weak and below potential. Growth in the second half of 2023 was close to zero, allowing supply to catch up with demand. Labor markets have continued to ease gradually. With employment growing more slowly than population, the labor market has come into better balance. job vacancies have returned to more normal levels, and the pace of hiring has been modest. Wage growth has been in the 4 to 5% range for some time now, but there are now signs that wage pressures may be easing. CPI inflation eased to 2.9% in January. This largely reflected lower energy prices and easing in food price inflation, as well as weakness in semi-durable prices like footwear and clothing. But shelter price inflation remains elevated and is still the biggest contributor to overall inflation. More broadly, underlying price pressures persist. Our preferred measures of core inflation eased in January, but remain above 3% on a year-over-year and a three-month basis. As well, the share of CPI components rising faster than 3% declined, but is still above the historical average. Looking ahead, we continue to expect inflation to be close to 3% through the middle of this year before easing in the second half. Gasoline prices are expected to continue to add volatility to inflation in coming months, and shelter price pressures are likely to persist. In other words, the path back to the 2% target will be slow, and progress is likely to be uneven. Governing Council also discussed the risks to the economy and inflation. Risks to global energy prices and transportation costs related to conflicts remain elevated. Domestically, inflation could prove more persistent than expected. We don't want to keep monetary policy this restrictive for longer than we have to, but nor do we want to jeopardize the progress we've made in bringing inflation down. Governing Council remains concerned about the persistence of underlying inflation, and we want to see further deceleration in core inflation in the coming months. We remain focused on the indicators of inflationary pressures that we've mentioned before. Demand pressures have eased, and the economy now looks to be in modest excess supply. With the labor market coming into better balance, we are looking for further evidence that wage growth is moderating. Before our April decision, we'll also get new information on corporate pricing behavior and inflation expectations. We'll be looking for the frequency and size of price increases to continue to normalize, and for short-term inflation expectations to ease further. We've come a long way in our fight against inflation. Monetary policy is working, inflation is coming down. But it's too early to loosen the restrictive stance of policy that has gotten us this far. Low, stable inflation is a cornerstone of shared prosperity, and we remain resolute in our commitment to restore price stability.
So as you just heard, inflation is coming down somewhat, but still far too early to consider taking down that interest rate. VOCM's Jerry Lynn Mackey had a conversation with Larry Short, senior advisor with Short Financial IA Private Wealth, about the likelihood of a cut in the interest rate perhaps later this year. Here's some of what he had to say.
In the next scheduled discussion about it, is in June, and really unlikely to happen at that time as well, simply because there has to be really a lot of evidence that there is a slowdown happening in inflation for the government, for the central bank to make that change. So understand that the first cut that the first change that the central bank makes in interest rates tends to be the most important because it signals the direction of future interest rate increases or decreases. So when they start to raise rates, they tend to raise rates for at least a year or often more. When they cut rates, same sort of thing tends to happen. It is a significant change in policy, and they would really have to see strong evidence to indicate that interest rates should be cut for them to make a change.
Why would an interest rate cut in April be considered a poor decision by some economists?
Looking at the unemployment rate, is an indicator of how strong the economy is. If people are continuing to be hired, it tends to be that the economy is doing really, really well. And again, it's not that in isolation. They look at other factors. The other factor in Canada's case is that we're right next door to one of the single largest economies in the world, and that economy is absolutely booming. So while there's a tremendous amount of construction and rebuilding and, they're building everything, roads and bridges and airports and the like, it means our largest customer is doing really, really well. So that kind of indicates that our economy is going to continue to do well over the next year. And therefore, the likelihood of a slowdown happening in the Canadian economy is relatively, the likelihood is low. So as a consequence, the central bank will more than likely maintain interest rates where they are until maybe as late as September.
Larry, a lot of homeowners and business owners are hurting because of the high interest rates. How could overlooking that sad reality impact the central bank's decision and reputation?
Well, here's the reality. The intention of raising interest rates is to cause people to hesitate to make new home purchases or businesses to expand. That's that's how you slow down an economy, is that you remove, you reduce demand for housing or construction, et cetera, in an economy. So that's the reason that we're seeing interest rates stay high. That being said, if you look at mortgage rates, for example, we're seeing one-year mortgage rates at around 5%. But we're seeing five-year rates at about 4.84%. So, you know, not a huge difference, but it does indicate that the, the economists, the financial gurus, are expecting that eventually interest rates will be cut. It's a question of when.
You also mentioned that, you know, over the next year, it does look like the economy will be rebuilding and strengthening. What might it look like this time next year when it comes to interest rates, do you think?
So the one-year rate is a little bit less than the five-year rate right now, meaning that the economists are expecting that interest rates will be cut at some point this year. And again, when we factor in the, you know, our largest customer being the U.S. and the economy there, we tend to follow what happens with interest rates there. Not 100%, but the likelihood of an interest rate cut happening in the U.S. probably either August or September is very high. One of the reasons for that is that they are as well trying to ensure that the U.S. economy does not go into a recession. And the last time that the central bank is supposed to no longer interfere in a potential in the U.S. election is somewhere around that August period. That's probably the single best indicator for the direction of interest rates in Canada. If we see them cut, we're probably going to get a cut happening in Canada on or shortly after that.
And that is Larry Short, Senior Advisor with Short Financial, IA Private Wealth. So what he's saying is don't expect a rate drop anytime soon, at least not in June month, although many have been suggesting that a rate drop could be coming. But as Tiff Macklem also pointed out, that they have to wait and see how the measures they've taken to quell inflation are working, and that takes some time. Well, when we come back, the NDP is sounding the alarm following the revelation that a number of unclaimed bodies, of unclaimed bodies have reached such a level that temporary units were installed to keep human remains frozen in storage. And they are sitting outside the Health Sciences Center next to a dumpster, and that's led to an awful lot of questions, both from the public and from politicians. We're going to hear what NDP leader Jim Dinh has to say on that. And a little later on in the show, we're going to take you to Russia. We're not going to take you to Russia. We're going to take you to Memorial University for a discussion on Russia and what's happening in that country with the so-called presidential election on the horizon there. So stay tuned for that as well. You're listening to VOCM News Talk. Hello.
Do we want to bring up the weather again?
Sure. That's what I was afraid you were going to, which
know.
Is why I hesitated.
Yeah, but I just feel that I'm noticing on social media now more and more people are posting what Environment Canada has said. It's becoming real now because, mm-hmm. you know, when you hear about all the uncertain models, you're thinking, oh, there is a chance that we're not going to get all of that. But now they're saying 40 to 70, Northern Avalon Peninsula, including St. John's and vicinity. And I mentioned earlier on that on Thursday night, so there's certain areas along the southern shore, they're going to see the snow transition to the ice pellets. That means that they're going to get less snowfall there, but the ice pellets are expected to change back to snow on Friday. So, yeah.
Just makes it heavier.
Exactly. To shovel.
Yay.
And it does make it real when it says to consider postponing those non-essential travel until the conditions improve again from Thursday evening until Saturday.
There you go. And that is, and as we talked about it yesterday, is the duration of this storm. Like many of the storms that we've seen over the course of this winter, it's the duration that's adding to these accumulation amounts. Oh my goodness gracious, those 50 to 70. Anyway, we'll have more details on that throughout the day tomorrow. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Saturday morning, join us for the Irish Newfoundland Show. Send your request to irishnl@vocm.com or submit them online at vocm.com.
We are back. Well, the NDP is sounding the alarm following the revelation that the number of unclaimed bodies has reached such a level that temporary units were installed to keep human remains frozen in storage. It's our understanding that the freezers have been there for months and another one was added late last year. NDP leader Jim Dinh joins me now. Well, Jim Dinh, the NDP now raising serious concerns about this story indicating that unclaimed human remains are being held in storage and that the solution appears to be getting more freezer units to hold these bodies. What's happening?
I'll begin by this because it's such a sensitive topic, and there are probably families out there listening who are whose loved ones, the remains of their loved ones, are probably in these storage units, in these freezer units, and I can't imagine what they are going through and having to make that decision. My heart and compassion does go out to them, but I do believe that this is something that could have been and should have been dealt with years ago. It horrifies me, I'll be honest, that the solution that government has is simply to install more freezer units, freeze the bodies, and basically deny the people the option of and the choice of how their loved ones will be disposed of. It's a case of affordability, and it seems to be that government is again more focused on the nickels and dimes and the cost to them rather than on compassion towards its citizens, so that they could have a proper and respectful funeral or a memorial service.
I spoke to a funeral director some months ago who raised a similar concern, saying that for people on income assistance, the funeral homes were simply not being compensated to the degree that, in other words, they had to shoulder the rising costs of funeral services, which are very costly and involve quite a bit of work. So why haven't we seen any change in the compensation that government provides to funeral homes to provide dignified funeral services?
That's a good question. And actually, that's how this first came to my attention way back in 2021 or late 2020, early 2021. And it had to do with that very thing, that very issue. And at the time, there was, as to how we were going to deal with it, there seemed to be some movement or discussion with government that they were going to find a resolution. Obviously, a few weeks ago, my office was contacted by a healthcare worker who's one of the loved ones were in the hospital morgue, stacked on a gurney, and they were deeply upset. They weren't the next of kin, so we decided to follow up on this and to apply an access to information request, and we sent a letter to Minister Pike, Hogan, and Osborne at the time. So to me, it indicates, it's interesting that this problem has been going on for at least 3 years or more, if I want to get up to 5 years at least, and we're now coming to this, it's out in the public, and I'm sure what we're going to see is a flurry of activity and a flurry of announcements by the government as to how they're going to deal with this. And to me, it's again a sort of a reactionary solution as opposed to working proactively to resolve some of the long-standing issues, whether it's about streamlining the process, increasing the fees, indexing them to inflation, working with the funeral homes in a meaningful consultation process to resolve it, or to even develop protocols and policies that basically allow for the respectful disposition of bodies that have remained unclaimed. All those things are within government to do, and yet here we are today, knowing that the solution is, well, we'll install more freezer units, and that's just at the health sciences. We're not, our ATIP is more or less looking at what about in the hospital, the morgues of other hospitals, what is the total number of this province in the province.
Do we have any indication of how many families are facing this kind of scenario right now?
We don't know. That's part of our ATIP as to how many. But I will tell you that any family out there now who's modest means, like I said, people who are barely keeping up with rent, barely putting food on the table, barely keeping their medications, affording their medications. This has got to be a source of stress. It's affordability. It's the high cost of living. And even now, the high cost of dying for some families. But I guess, Linda, it's interesting that the government's approach to things, because we argued, and I'll go back to CERB, and I use this as a pattern here. We asked government not, and a number of poverty groups asked government not to claw back CERB, the provincial government to claw back CERB from income support recipients. They did. We've seen the housing crisis evolve so that people on income support or modest means are being priced out of the housing market. Families can't afford to pay the rent. We've seen everything about when it comes to a meaningful affordability that this government has failed to react. And so I think here it is, the final insult is to have, we see now people are left with the, I can only call it a rather unsettling, upsetting, traumatizing decision to leave their loved ones in long-term storage because they really are not able to afford the burial. And that is problematic. And I think, if nothing else, there are simpler solutions here if government has the political will to do it.
Add to that, of course, the rising number of mental health and addictions issues and young people who are dying suddenly and unexpectedly.
For those that come under the chief medical examiner, he does have the authority to when it comes to a more streamlined process for the disposition of bodies. But let's keep in mind too that we also have an aging population. And you can only imagine that the number of deaths will increase at some point and already. So what is the plan, I guess? It comes down to what is a respectful, dignified plan to help people? I think we were talking beforehand, the rates haven't increased in 19, almost 20 years. Well, that amounts to a cut. We know that the cost of living has gone up for families of all incomes. And for those who are, you know, like a modest incomes, those who are maybe minimum wage, those who are on fixed pensions, it's a significant challenge. And if they don't have a pension plan that allows for some, like a post, you know, 65 or they don't a burial, or they don't they're unable to claim CPP, you name it, it's a significant process. It's a significant challenge. So if anything else, if you look at the 90, I think it's a 9-page application process for people to fill out if they need government assistance, which again tells me that government is more focused on the nickels and dimes than on being compassionate. So simplify the process, allow for the disposition of the respectful disposition of remains, work with the families, allow them to bury their loved ones in a respectful and dignified way, work with the families after to recoup any cost that you need, work with the funeral homes, come up with a policy and that doesn't happen going forward. And I would say, if you a simplest way, rather than having to review the cost, index it to inflation. And you know what, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Jim Dinn, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Take care, Linda. Thank you.
And that is NDP leader Jim Dinn. Well, when we come back, the sudden death of Alexei Navalny, one of the Kremlin's most vocal opponents, has many wondering what's next. We'll speak with Memorial University political scientist Lucian Ashworth when we come back right after this.
Nutrition, exercise, keeping the cold at bay. Whatever keeps you feeling great, the Wellness and Healthy Lifestyle Show on your VOCM.
And we are back. Well, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's widow is urging his supporters to join a protest of the presidential election on the 17th of this month. Yulia Navalnaya wants Russians opposed to President Vladimir Putin to get in line at voting stations on the last and main day of voting and vote for anyone but Putin or ruin their ballot. Navalny was reported dead in an Arctic penal colony, on February 16th. His death, of course, is still unexplained. Well, that's one. The death of Alexei Navalny, one of the Kremlin's most vocal opponents, has many wondering what's next. Lucian Ashworth is a political scientist at MUN, and he joins me now. Well, Lucian, Alexei Navalny's body has been returned to his family and is buried now in Moscow. What kind of an impact do you think his passing and the work that he had done in exposing Putin and corruption at the highest levels in Russia is going to continue to have?
Well, yeah, that's a difficult question, and particularly because in some respects, all bets are off with the way that the regime has tightened up security. And we're also not talking about a particularly strong opposition either. So in some respects, you know, this is when we're looking at Russia, and I've seen this with kind of Russian experts as well talking about it, is that at the moment the regime appears to be keeping a lid on things, that it's able to control security. But having said that, this could be in the medium term or even in the longer term a mistake. You can see that it was kind of galvanizing people to come out onto the streets. The other thing as well with this kind of regime is that we're probably looking at it being very, very stable until it suddenly collapses. So there may be, this isn't probably enough to push the regime over, but it could be one of the many events that lead up to problems for the regime. But the problem, as I say, is that this is a relatively opaque political system, so it's very difficult to read the tea leaves in that sense.
particularly in light of a looming election, quotations, if you will, that will secure Putin for another indefinite term. The change may not happen politically, is what I'm saying. You're saying there may be something else that might trigger change in that country.
Yes, I mean we're looking at a number of issues. With the ongoing war in Ukraine at the moment, the war seems relatively popular. But again, think about the U.S. experience with Vietnam, how that can change on a dime. You can see how the events of 1968. Turned the country against the war. So it could be that demonstrations emerge because of the amount of deaths that are occurring on the front line. We've also got issues of you know, how long can Putin remain in power. He's not a young man. There's all sorts of possibilities there in terms of sudden change at the top. But at the moment, there doesn't seem to be anything there that might suggest that there's going to be a sudden change of regime at the moment. But again, as I say, these things can turn on a dime in political systems like Russia.
Alexei Navalny was rather unique in that he was charismatic, he was smart, he was witty, he was funny, and he knew how to manipulate social media to get his message out. Do you see anybody on the horizon in Russia that would fill that kind of a role, or was he unique in the brass neck that he had?
Well, I think, you know, there's always people who can emerge, and there also are quite a number of other quite high-profile Kremlin critics in prison in a sort of similar situation to Navalny. There's also the role of Navalny's widow, and, you know, there's all sorts of various other organizations right across the political spectrum that we could see emerge. So in that sense, you know, Navalny is a very important and, as you say, charismatic figurehead and sort of focus. But at the same time, it's not individuals alone that make history. You know, there has to be some kind of sort of structural change, organization, and so forth. And of course, Navalny had organized quite a strong opposition as an opposition politician, and much of that organization is still there.
It's been said that women triggered the Russian Revolution, female workers in factories fed up with their working conditions. And we're seeing a growing, opposition to the war in Ukraine from mothers and widows and wives of soldiers who are saying, you know, our the men in our lives are nothing more than cannon fodder here. Do you think that it will be those kinds of sentiments that may turn the tide in Russia and Ukraine, for that matter?
Well, yeah, that's an organization that it would be very difficult for the regime to clamp down on. And they have in the past had quite successful demonstrations, even going back to the war in Chechnya as well, where the wives and mothers played a very powerful role in often getting their conscript men back from the war as well. So that's a possibility. On top of that, though, we have to include the economy. And, of course, Russia is under quite strict sanctions at the moment. You know, it often finds ways to get around those sanctions. But those sanctions will, after a while, begin to bite. Particularly problematic for the regime is that it does rely on rents from its selling of natural resources, particularly oil and gas. And while it's managed to keep up those sales by switching to other sources other than Europe, This may bring in less resources, less money for the government, which in turn could have severe issues for the economy. Also, the economy has gone on to a war footing as well. So we might see, as the economic factors begin to bite, and as the long play out of sanctions begins to have an effect on the Russian economy, that this may also be a source for unrest directed at the government.
And what about Russia's relationship with the West? We're watching what's happening south of the border now, Super Tuesday coming up. If there's a change at the top in the United States, might that be the trigger for something different?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that. Yeah, what's going to happen here? It is interesting that actually, officially, and there may be reasons why they've said this, but officially, of course, Putin a while back actually said that he hoped that Biden would win because Biden was more predictable. But there are issues about how the issue about relationship with Russia and Ukraine has become a victim of hyper polarization and partisanship in the United States. So that's a concern. There's also issues about what the position of Hungary will be and of Slovakia towards a kind of European unity over the issue of Ukraine. But at the moment, and all things being equal, what we've actually seen is a polarization in the West and a kind of a rally round the flag over the issue of Ukraine and continued support for Ukraine and for NATO. And of course, we recently had the vote in Hungary that was the last to confirm Sweden's membership of NATO. So one of the major effects of the war in Ukraine and the Russian invasion has in fact been, ironically, an expansion of NATO with Finland and Sweden joining now. So, in that sense, there is both sort of potential fissures in the West's stand against Russia, but at the same time, the trends at the moment, at least, seem to be that united front will continue, but we'll have to see, because I mean, this is the thing: what would a Trump presidency do in terms of Ukraine and Russia? Would it change U.S. policy? What would happen with the elections to the European parliaments later this year? So there's a whole series of imponderables that we don't have crystal balls to see beyond those, to see what would happen.
Lucian Ashworth, I really do appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
No problem at all.
And speaking of the goings-on south of the border, Nikki Haley did not endorse Donald Trump when she suspended her campaign for the Republican presidential nomination this morning. She says it's now up to him to win the support of the moderate Republicans and independent voters who supported her. U.S. President Joe Biden is welcoming any voters who backed Haley. He believes they can find common ground on the fundamental issues of preserving American democracy or standing up for the rule of law and on treating each other with decency, dignity, and respect. Well, that's it for us for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Do join us then. We'll keep you up to date on all the latest on the coming weather system. All the appropriate amounts and all, I say, looking at Claudette. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye for now.